Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Anne Parfit, and she will be speaking on euthanasia. Whose life is it anyway? So let's listen in on Anne.
Welcome, my name is Anne Parfit, and this session in ethics is called Euthanasia, Whose Life Is It Anyway? I'm going to refer to a number of resources throughout this session, and I'm going to tell you what they are up front, and if you want a bibliography later, I'll be glad to write them down. The first one is a book called Faith, Formation, and Decision by James M. Childs, Augsburg Fortress Publishing. It's been out, I think, 3 or 4 years. It's a new book. We'll be using this one. I'll be referring to the case of Elizabeth Bouvier, and that comes from Classic Cases in Medical Ethics by John Pence, Harcourt Brace. We will refer to one Beatitudes biblical reference from the NRSV is the version I'm using, and then Sojourner's Magazine for a quote from a man by the name of No One. What I'd like to do is to have an interactive discussion among all of us. I'll give some basic background on what is ethics, and then talk about the principles that I think fall into the Bouvier case, and then introduce Elizabeth and her case, and try and involve all of us, because there were various perspectives that came out in this case, and you all will want to offer things as well. When I introduce the case, I will hand out positions that are taken by various people, and you can grab a sheet if you're comfortable doing that. And we'll talk about the positions that were taken by the various people, and you can say whether or not you agree with them, and there are ways to do that. I also want to introduce Gail, who is the nurse here. And she can provide some very special, unique perspectives on the medical attitudes that come into cases like this one. She and I talked earlier, and she's got a firm handle on some of the things that come up, not only in this case, but in similar cases. So she'll keep us on track there. Has anybody ever been an attorney, a lawyer? Okay, good. So we can say whatever we want about lawyers. Okay. The first thing I want to do is talk about ethics and what ethics are. And I'm going to do this really basic, broad, general overview so that we don't spend a lot of time in detail. But I want to explain ethics in this way. Most of the time when we make ethical decision making, we look at it either in terms of, is it right or wrong? Is it good or bad? And we weigh our alternatives, and we look at what we're going to do in terms of what are the consequences going to be? How will this work out? What I'm going to talk about with regard to ethics is with regard to what's right versus what's good. Because most of us don't go here, and most of us don't go here, but the dilemmas that we get ourselves into fall between these two areas when we can't balance one against the other, or where we have these internal wars and we don't know, do we want to do what's right or do we want to do what's good, and the tension in this imperfect world makes the decisions very, very difficult. Now, one way to consider this is this way. If we look at what's right, the rules that we get from doing what's right are like looking at a coloring book. And if we do what's right, our obligation is to make sure that we color in the lines. And just stay in the lines, like this. Follow the rules, okay? I think I'll give this one a red roof. Whoops, I went outside the lines. And you can basically get the idea here. And very, very few times are we ever risky enough to go outside the lines and maybe add something that wasn't there. Okay? Now, when we are working with the good, we have a blank canvas. And we can do a lot of other things because we don't have lines to stay with within. Now, Dr. Childs talks about rule ethics. And with that, he differentiates them this way. Rule ethics prescribes behavior instead of inviting decision making. Prescribes behavior. Yesterday, Dorothy Bass talked about hospitality in an inhospitable world. And with that, she talked a little bit about how you know whether or not you're going to accept a dinner invitation. And sometimes people write into Ann Landers or Miss Manners, and they try and find out what the very primitive, she calls manners a very primitive way of knowing what we're supposed to do. With the dialogical method that Childs talks about, as well as other people, we follow Love's general rules. And the first thing we do are ascertain the facts, and we know what the facts are. We learn this in school, the scientific method. We all follow the scientific method. It's observable, it's measurable, and it's repeatable. Other than that, it can't exist. Well, maybe the resurrection. I don't think that's repeatable. But most of the time, we look at our scientific facts and we say, it exists if it's this way. So with the dialogical method, we do look at the facts. We consider the facts, but we don't just stop there. The next thing we need to do is talk about what is going on. Now, since I'm talking about Child's book, and I don't want to lose what he has to say about this, and he says it better than I do, I'm going to refer to that just a little bit and tell you what he says about the rules of love. The general rules of love, in contrast to legalism, talk about a new life of love in the gospel that keeps alive the tension of judgment and possibility, the tension of law and gospel that is characteristic in the not yet situation. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the general rules of love. Now, he also talks about the dialogical method and the dialogical ethics that we're talking about here. And again, not to lose Childs, let me add a couple of things that he says here before we move on to Elizabeth Bouvier and the principles involved in her case. Dialogical ethics comes from the observation that moral decision can happen only after love's general rules are brought into dialogue with the situation of moral choice, whether that is a personal encounter or a matter of social concern. Because love's general rules are broadly stated or characterized by generality, they do not present us with a clear prescription in many cases. We have a canvas. As the community of faith gathers around word and sacrament, it is always in dialogue with the world. In that dialogue, the faith sheds light on the nature of the world and our hopes for it. And the world situation opens up new dimensions of the meaning and significance of the faith. Since appreciation for the situation is so important in ethical decision, good ethics will strive to understand the facts of the situation. And thus, in the realm of bioethics, decisions on abortion, euthanasia, genetic control, and so on, we need to be as sure of the medical and scientific facts as possible. Now, there are some dangers and some pitfalls, and he cites two of them in particular and then makes a third reference. And he says, the first danger when we try to do biomedical ethics is to become so entangled in our fact-finding that our feelings of frustrations at not having adequate knowledge of the facts paralyzes our ability to make decisions. The second one, somewhere down on the page, says the second pitfall involved in our attempt to appreciate the facts of the situation is the failure to recognize that facts are not always simple and straightforward matters. The details of any life situation usually come to us clothed in the interpretations given to them by the people with whom we are involved and viewed by us through our own interpretive lenses. This is important because this moves to his third point, and that is, what is going on? This requires us not only simply to ask, what are the facts, but to move beyond that and to ask, what is going on in the minds and the feelings of all persons who are involved, including ourselves? And that comes from Childs, pages 84 to 86. So as we do this particular case with Elizabeth Bouvier, we want to keep asking ourselves, what's going on? Now, in Elizabeth's case, There are a number of standards that are a number of principles that will come out of this, and a number of ethical standards we could apply, but I think the one that is most obvious is what it is to be human. And from a Christian perspective, at least, we're going to say here that to be human is to be in a relationship with God. And that means a personal existence with God characterized by freedom and responsibility for one another. That means that we uphold the humanity of other persons, and that comes out of our obligation as we love God. Respecting autonomy, again from Childs, says that this includes a willing to protect the freedom of others to make their own judgments and decisions, to give each person the right to be his or her own person, provided it does not harm others or deny others their own freedom. I want to say that again because that's the heart of this case with Elizabeth Bouvier. As we think through what's happening and what is said by everybody who's involved in her case, we want to decide whether or not, or think through whether or not, because we will be deciding, whether or not this includes, to quote Childs, a willingness to protect the freedom of Elizabeth Bouvier to make her own judgment and decision, to give her the right to be her own person, provided it does not harm others or deny others their own freedoms. So we'll talk about Elizabeth Bouvier today. Now let me introduce you to her. And I'll tell you a little bit about her. I brought a wheelchair in because Elizabeth has been in a wheelchair all her life. And we have some history on her. Elizabeth is 25 years old. She's almost totally paralyzed, and she's suicidal. Tell you a little bit more about her from the case. She's never had the use of her legs. She's had enough control over her right hand to operate a battery-powered wheelchair and to smoke cigarettes, and enough control of her facial muscles that she can chew and swallow and speak. She can't turn this page. In September 1983, that's the year, her father drove her from Oregon to Riverside General Hospital, where she admitted herself as a voluntary patient to the psychiatric ward. She was a California resident who had lived in both Riverside and Oregon and was eligible for Medi-Cal, a substantial supplement to Medicaid for indigent California residents. She was admitted for being suicidal when she declared that she wanted to be, quote, just left alone and not bothered by friends or family or anyone else, and to ultimately starve to death. Now, why did she want to do this? When she was 5, her parents divorced. She lived for a while with her mother, but eventually she moved to a children's home, and she received some support as required by the state from her father. When she was 18, and if you remember when we were 18, we got presents. Maybe use of the second car became more available to us as we graduated. When Elizabeth was 18, her father said, "I can't afford to support you anymore. I'm a postal worker. My income is low, and we need to seek the state support that you're entitled to since you are now legally an adult." Elizabeth responded to this by getting her own apartment and hiring a live-in nurse. She had quit school when she was 15 or 16. She earned her GED, went on to earn a BA, and started to earn a master's degree, but ran into some problems with the school. They said that basically there was no work for her. Her disability was too great, and they just couldn't continue to work with her. She did some volunteer work in the placement office there. Eventually, when she was 24, she married an ex-convict whom she had met through letter writing. She conceived a child that year and had a miscarriage. Her husband lost his job. It had been part-time and benefits were limited, but he was responsible for her care because he was married to her. So the state support ended when they married. Eventually, the problems became too much for her husband, and he abandoned her, saying that he couldn't live up to the responsibilities. And the year that she was 25, she admitted herself with her father to the psychiatric hospital, claiming that she wanted to commit suicide through starvation. Quoting the case, it says, Bouvier had decided that she would not eat and would starve herself to death, saying, death is letting go of all burdens. It's being able to be free of my physical disability and mental struggle to live. Now, a great many people were involved, as I said, in this case. And if you would help me, I would like to ask you to pass these around. There are a number of them here, and if you would be willing to take one, represent that particular body, and hold up the sheet and read what's on the back of it, so we can all talk about the various constituencies that were involved in this. And then if you don't want one of those cards, take one of these and then pass these around so that we can talk about what is going on. Okay? I'll take a couple of these and take them to the other side. And whenever somebody says something that you don't want to let go, what is going on? Okay? And the sheets that you have are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7A, 7B, and 8. Okay? So if we can begin, if you have number 1.
Yes, number 1, ACLU.
Okay, the American Civil Liberties Union. What do you have to say about Elizabeth?
We will not ask the physician to act against Elizabeth's conscience. We will ask the doctor to withdraw from the case.
Number 2.
I'm Donald Fisher, the chief of psychiatry at the hospital. I'm opposed to her request to allow starvation. The court cannot order me to be a murderer, nor to conspire with my staff and employees to murder Elizabeth.
Okay. Who has number 3? Richard Nixon.
In my letter to Elizabeth, I encouraged her to, quote, keep fighting, unquote. By the way, I've heard that a meeting with President Reagan is being discussed.
Anybody have anything to say about any of these? Okay, number 4. Does anybody have a 4 in the corner?
2 neurosurgeons. I'm willing to provide free surgery to help Elizabeth Bouvier gain the use of her arms. Me too.
Okay, first and second surgery. Sure, surgeon.
She's getting help from the hospital.
These are other surgeons who step in and say, I've read about your case. Okay, number 5.
I've got the convicted felon. Is that her husband?
No, not her husband. A convicted felon.
She wants to die? Fine, I'll shoot her.
These really happened. Judge?
The court finds on behalf of Riverside Hospital.
Judge Hughes?
Yes.
Number 6?
Although Ms. Bouvier is rational, sincere, and fully competent, her request would have a profound effect on the medical staff, the nurses, and the administration of the hospital, as well as a devastating effect on other physically handicapped persons.
Okay. 7A and B.
Call Ms. Jack Anderson. I'm willing to write about the Bouvier case, advocating creation of a fund to pay for treatment for her handicaps.
It was refused. Oh. What about Arthur Hopp?
I had a feeling that the judge, the doctor in the hospital, found Elizabeth Bouvier guilty. Guilty of not playing the game. It was as though the Easter Seal child had looked into the camera and said, being crippled was a lousy deal, and certainly nothing to smile about.
And the Law Institute?
Number 8?
Yes.
Yeah. Representative for the Law Institute of the Disabled. Bouvier symbolizes a social problem. She needs to learn to live with dignity.
She's very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. What's going on? What's happening?
Nobody's listening to her.
To Elizabeth.
To Elizabeth, yes.
And what is Elizabeth saying?
She's saying that she wants it over with.
Uh-huh.
And she has a right to what she wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody else wants to listen to this.
Okay, any other comments on this?
What is going on is that the Bouvier case was the seed, really, for activating hospital ethics committees
mm-hmm.
to prevent exactly this sort of thing from happening. The idea being that the medical profession, speaking as one, are ultimately in the best position to determine her situation and ultimately her fate. But once it's gone beyond that, into the press, into the courts, then it no longer becomes, then it's out of the arena of really the medical profession, and as we see here, it becomes a free-for-all, and her fate, the real medical ethical questions become muddied and perhaps lost.
Very much so, especially in this case. It doesn't just happen in this case. It happens in a lot of cases, and these issues are the kinds of issues that families grapple with as well. When we're facing a life and death situation like this, we tend to gather as much information and seek as much, and as Child said, the first danger is that we become immobilized. We get into fact-finding, and what we find are facts, but we don't find a decision because we're looking for the right and the good and trying to balance those, and the canvas is blank. Love's general rule is difficult to interpret. The case as it moved forward, does anybody else have anything else to say, Peter?
Well, I think it's rather, odd that you check into a psychiatric hospital, qualify for help, and then announce your intended suicide. That's a real double message.
Good point.
You're asking someone to join you in the process and really go against the express purpose of where you checked in.
I don't know if it was simultaneous, though, was it? I mean, it was like she decided she wanted to end her life, and then at that same instant called the hospital, or was there like a gap there where...
The case says that she asked her father to drive her to the hospital.
Oh, so she just thought about it and then all of a sudden started talking about it. But there must have been, a period of time in which she turned it over and over in her mind.
For that year, she'd gone through all of those things.
Sure.
Well, I was going to say, does she have support at that point? I mean, did she go into the hospital to get some support? Her husband abandons her. The state's no longer supporting her. What's happening to her?
Her husband did jump in at one point and say that the media and the medical professionals were taking advantage of her and they ought to leave her alone. But that's as much support as she got in terms of what I'm hearing you ask about.
Yeah.
Yes.
What about her father's involvement? How much was he knowledgeable because he drove her in?
That's as far as the case doesn't mention him again at all. He drove her in and...
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, facts, could she check herself out?
We'll see. Yeah, she could.
I have great sympathy for this doctor.
Why is that?
In that it's his job on any suicide watch to, buy time for somebody to change her mind, I would think. Because historically many people do see things differently with help and time, and to begin the assisted suicide kind of goes against his whole raison d'etre, which is to enable people to live on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the felon, I've got sympathy with him. She wants to die, I'll do it. I mean, if you will, that seems more of a pure act.
Okay.
But the very word assisted suicide doesn't seem to apply. If you're starving yourself, you don't need assistance to not eat. So that, what Peter started originally saying,
yeah.
it's a contradiction there. But she doesn't need support to starve her to death. She's without support, and she doesn't need support either.
Okay, that's a perspective that there may have been something else going on. Why did she really go into the psychiatric hospital? Gail?
Well, one of the things that you said that you read and you reread it about freedom to make the choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's from a nurse's perspective. When a patient comes into the hospital where I worked in Minnesota, the patient is read and told on admission that they have rights. There's a patient's bill of rights. You can refuse treatment. But many people do not know how to do that. And many times the medical profession doesn't really oftentimes give the people the information. I mean, you know, they're sick, they, you know, the doctor, I'm speaking more probably from the physician, but will say, you know, this is what we're gonna do. Oftentimes there's not like these, there's four different things we can do here. And so I guess I feel that sometimes that people don't have the information, they're in powerless positions, they have lack of control, and oftentimes I don't really know that ethically that they get all the information and also know that they have choices.
So if you'd hold that up, what is going on?
So I just feel that I've seen this happen many, many times.
Okay.
And as a nurse, that people are kept alive and we just, you know, don't tell them the choices. And frankly, you know, this is my own personal opinion, but I feel that sometimes we prolong people's life and make them suffer much more than if they would say, okay, this is what I want to do. I have lived this life and I want to die and I want to be allowed to die and I should be able to do this and not have my life prolonged any longer.
Okay, now that fits with Elizabeth because she's not terminally ill and she doesn't want to prolong her life. If the patient is terminally ill, are we prolonging life or are we prolonging the death process? Which one are we prolonging? With Elizabeth, it'd be prolonging life because she's not terminally ill.
Right.
But with a person who has terminal cancer,
mm-hmm.
are we prolonging life or are we prolonging death? Which
process.
Are we doing?
The death process. Yeah.
The death process.
Mm-hmm.
That's a question that we grapple with in these situations.
Point of fact, I mean, most people, I mean, times have changed. To get to stay in a hospital is, in these days, a mighty act.
Mm-hmm.
And people who, I mean, the chief want to stay there and just do this on their time?
Yes. Yes. That was her original
fill
request.
Fill a bed and starve yourself to death.
Yes, her original request.
Did she want palliative care in the process of starving?
Yes.
Is that why she went to the hospital? So that it would be less painful? I understand that.
Yeah,
okay.
That's the assumption that's made as we get further into this.
Okay.
But it's an assumption that's made rather than a given because it doesn't get to that point quite.
But did she require palliative care?
That's where we're going next with this. Did she? At one point, there's a question about that.
With her chronic condition, did she require analgesia along the way, or was it
well, it depends
any other supportive care other than nutrition?
How far did she get in the process to know, for us to know whether or not
she
required that?
Prior to going into the hospital, did she require any?
No. Not up to that point. They did say that she was experiencing arthritis, and there was significant pain with that. So that would have required some care on top of everything else. Arthritis is setting in. Now I'm going to move very quickly through her appeals, and then we can move forward with a couple of the things that happened with the case. As it was finally decided. There are some things that were printed that are kind of interesting, and I'll share them with you because they just shed some light on the case in terms of what was happening in 1983. There was a law professor by the name of George Annis who did not agree with the court's decision to to force feed Elizabeth Bouvier. And he said, the judge's decision begs the question, is there a reasonable option? In the adversary proceeding played out in California, no one seemed to search for reasonable options. The county, in fact, consistently took the most extreme position. It continually threatened to eject Ms. Bouvier from the hospital by force and leave her out on the front sidewalk, hoping someone would pick her up and take her away. Almost from the beginning, the county and hospital made it clear that they did not care whether she lived or died, but because of their own fear of potential legal liability, would not let her die at Riverside Hospital. What's going on?
Where's the law?
Yeah. Is this really what is going on, though? This is the law perspective, lawyer's perspective. That's the question that I had. I looked into the history of euthanasia, and I found that what was happening in the 1880s and 90s is the same thing that's happening in the 1990s and 80s and 90s. Lawyers and doctors are fighting the battle here, and it's become a battle of wills in some cases, with lawyers saying the patients have rights and doctors maintaining the attitude of paternalism. That's changed, of course, and it continues to change, but this is what lawyers continue to charge, is that the hospital... Okay. Okay, Georgianis continues. He says, I do not believe competent adults ever should be force-fed, but efforts at persuading the individual to change his or her mind and offer oral nutrition should continue. Like what you said, the decision shouldn't be made quickly. You know, take some time to think this through. If a court determines, however, that invasive force feeding is required, I'll ask you to tell people what that it means, what intubating means.
Well, oftentimes they will start out putting it down into the esophagus, into the stomach, but oftentimes it is a surgical procedure where they put a tube, a feeding tube, into the stomach, and then they're tube fed.
So it's a surgical procedure forced on the person. Then, to avoid hospitals from becoming the most hideous torture chambers, some reasonable limit must be placed on this quote-unquote treatment. Two physicians wrote in a journal called The Archives of Internal Medicine, and they said, the standoff continued until April 7 when Ms. Bouvier unexpectedly checked herself out of the hospital. She did check herself out. The hospital bill for the 217 days, excluding physicians' fees, was more than $56,000, paid by Riverside County and the state of California. Ms. Bouvier went to the Hospital Del Mar at Playa de Tijuana, Mexico, and that's the one that's known for the Laetril use treatments in cancer. She believed the staff would help her die. Her new physicians, however, became convinced that she wanted to live. 2 weeks later, Ms. Bouvier left the hospital, hired nurses, and moved to a motel, and 3 days later, with her friends, a reporter, and an intern from the Hospital Del Mar at her side, she gave up her plan to starve herself and took solid food. She said she wanted treatment, including surgery, to reduce the muscle spasms, and as of August 1985, her location and plans were not known. Her case was complicated further by the revelation that the newspaper reporter who covered the case most closely had a contract with Ms. Bouvier for a book, television, and movie rights to her story. Now, at the same time, George Annis, the lawyer, the law professor, continues to report, and this is his side of what happened. 2 years ago, this column dealt with Elizabeth Bouvier's unequal and doomed struggle. After losing both in the hospital and in the courtroom, Ms. Bouvier fled to Mexico on April 7, 1984 to seek her death. She was soon persuaded that Mexican physicians and nurses would be no more sympathetic to her plan than those at Riverside, and so returned to California. Because of the brutal force feeding she had endured at Riverside, she was afraid to return there. Since no other facility would admit her unless she agreed to eat, she resigned herself to eating and entered a private care location. There she remained without incident for more than a year. So the case continues. That's his version of the same thing. What's going on? The doctors in the Archives of Internal Medicine say she changed her mind, and the lawyer says she changed her mind because no one would
do what she wanted them to do, so she started taking her own actions.
If I can interject, to me this is kind of, it just seems all kind of hokey. I mean, if she really wanted to die, she could shut herself in her room and not eat. There's no law that can break into your house and shove a tube in your stomach. So it keeps coming back. The question to me is, you know, why was she reaching out for help in the first place unless she wanted to live?
Mm-hmm. So what's going on?
Right.
The facts of the case are far different from what's going on. We have to read behind what everyone's saying, what the lawyers are saying, the ACLU, the neurosurgeons who now want to help. And why would they want to help all of a sudden? Why would Richard Nixon suddenly get involved? And why would two neurosurgeons suddenly offer their services to this particular woman? Is it reasonable to say what's in it for me? Is it reasonable to say that this has become a highly public debate and to come in as the good guy in this situation and fix it would be a position that would be really pretty good for me? Or might we also be able to say, this is a place where I know I can do some help, I'm skilled as a neurosurgeon, or I have a position within the ACLU to protect this woman and I believe in this social justice? We don't really know. We can certainly interject or project our own ideas on what may be going on, but there are a lot of things happening. This case is public, so it allows us to experience this case from a lot of different perspectives. But even when this happens in our own families, we will find out that our aunt is going to think one thing. She was brought up in one generation. And the children are going to think another thing. And we're going to be suspect of the doctors. And we're going to look at the law and see what we are allowed to do. And we're going to gather all this information. So whether it's these outside people who have something to potentially gain in terms of being involved with this case, or whether it's our own families, we need to look at what's happening with this particular situation and dialogue it through. Not looking just at the facts, but also trying to interpret the facts in light of what's going on. And then to look at it in terms of the commandment of love. Rob?
In terms of looking at right and good, there seems to be the assumption of what is right is that she lives. But I think the question comes up of, is it good to force a style of living on her, to force her to live? The doctors, they seem to be wanting to force the right decision on her rather than allowing her to make that own decision, her own decision. Mm-hmm.
She's trying to force them into abandoning what they're committed to. I think that's what bothers me, as the person behind me suggested, and there's no law against locking yourself up and dying. And if indeed it was a cry for help, which even if I want to die, but I want to suffer while I'm dying, you can work with that.
The Hemlock Society.
Even in the sense that, I mean, in a psychiatric hospital, that decision isn't final. You put a gun to your head and you're done. I mean, it seems to me there's a little window of opportunity to keep this person alive, which is what I'm dedicated to as Dr. Fisher.
Okay.
And that although my methods to force feed may appear to be draconian, in the long run, that's what I'm pledged to do. You cannot ask me to deny my right to decision as a human being. I mean, what's in it for me is my integrity at this point, to do what I am about.
And as a doctor, you're about just keeping her alive. But what does that mean to be alive then? Is it just to lie in a bed in a hospital with some tubes in you and be breathing and...
This being a psychiatric hospital, I guess I'm reading into this a little bit more, which would be maybe part of the process is a process of healing that one could understand what's there. Because I would make that there are plenty of, quote, handicapped people who do find me. They in their lives. And but and looking at her record here, I can see a lot of other reasons for her great sadness and willingness to die, other than her disability. There was a time when, with this disability, we were in education, we were married, we were thinking of having a family, even with this disability. Therefore, what changed? Mm-hmm. To me, the social, emotional circumstances of what it is to be alive, not necessarily as handicapped since I've had since birth. And to me, it's not just a physical thing that's at stake here, but the whole emotional thing. I mean, even if it was just plain suicide, let alone the medical condition of being disabled severely, does anybody have to, should I discourage anyone from committing suicide? Mm-hmm. I'll just put it in that kind of terms, and absolutely yes.
Okay.
Not because it's a crime against God or anything, but because I believe there's a possibility for a new life after if we get out of the abyss we're in right now. That maybe you'll see it differently.
Are you saying it's a crime against God?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Is it in some ways a spiritual crisis that this woman is experiencing, and her behavior has engaged others like Judge and some of the doctors in their own spiritual crises?
We don't know, but it's a good question to ask.
Yeah, it's a question I'm left with as I look at what the judge's response was. Basically, the law allowed him to come back with that response, which says to me that I projected in my own crises, manifested in my belief that the hospital and the people in the hospital were going to somehow suffer. And the keyword suffer sort of showed up. I'm going to cause more suffering for other folks if I allow this to happen. I was just curious because people want to rescue her.
Yes, Nancy.
Two of the questions that keep occurring to me is, one, what business is it of ours to tell her what to do with her life? And number two, even though she was in a state of mind to want that, she was still a member of a community and still responsible. And was it responsible on her part to expect the state to fund her doing something in such a way that it would cost so much money? She could have, if she really wanted to commit suicide, she could have done it at home. And if things were favorable to that, she would have been able to get medication to help make it as painless as possible.
Well, this isn't somebody that had the opportunity to commit suicide. You know, if you can only maybe move one hand a little bit. I mean, you know, the only thing they can do is, in that position, is to rely on everybody else.
Oh, if you can smoke a cigarette, you can pop pills.
but who's going to take responsibility and want to give you those pills?
I keep thinking of Friedman's Fable. Did you know the one? Where the person throws the rope and says, he hands you under the rope and then jumps off the cliff and says, and they're holding on the other rope. Someone walks to you on a bridge. They hand you the end of the rope and then jump off. Okay? Mm-hmm. And you've got it. You've got to save me. You've got to help me. If you let go, I'm finished.
And how does that apply here?
But
I want you to say it.
It's real hard to say, but you are responsible for me indirectly, whether I live or die.
Okay. Yes.
Did she have, I haven't heard anything about relationships outside of the ex-husband and the father. Did she have friends? You know, do we know anything about her social? Was there any kind of support for her outside of all these political?
No long-term. Mm-hmm. No long-term friends that she was relying on.
Mm-hmm. So she may have very well been using the system because that's the only way, you know, she's not a part of a church. She didn't have any kind of connection with anybody to even talk about the pain she's going through.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move forward. Yes, Gail.
On that point, people who are almost totally paralyzed
most of those people are alienated from the society. I mean, even as a nurse, when a patient like that comes in to take care of them, that's a difficult patient to take care of. And then you start talking about the normal person who, as soon as you see somebody, if you see somebody who's paralyzed and spastic and so forth, are you going to go over there, and you're probably going to maybe want to have a relationship with somebody who's a little more healthy. So those people are really sort of outcasts from the society. So, and all that she's gone through, I doubt that she's probably going to have a lot of people who are going to be flocking around her.
Let me move forward with the case quickly, and then we can get into some of the other issues that are involved here. I went over what George Annis, the law professor, said, and I told you a little bit about what was said by the journal. Basically, the journal, the two physicians were portraying her as irresponsible, and of course, Annis continues to show her as a helpless heroine who's fighting a cold bureaucracy. The lawyers do. In 1985, 2 years after this started, she entered LA County USC Medical Center, and a morphine pump was installed to control pain for the degenerative arthritis. It had progressed to that point by then. At that point, she was then transferred to a nearby high desert hospital, and there she began to eat voluntarily. But the hospital people decided she wasn't eating enough. She weighed 70 pounds, and the hospital began force feeding her to achieve an ideal weight of 104 to 114 pounds, saying that since she is occupying our space, she must accede to the same care which we afford every other patient admitted here, care designed to improve and not detract from changes of recovery and rehabilitation. Several critics thought it was odd to reason that if a patient occupied a hospital's space, the patient had to do whatever the hospital said. I think that'd make a really interesting advertising slogan. Being in PR, I see those a lot. Of course, Elizabeth wasn't going to take that lying down, no pun intended, but she petitioned the courts for relief from the force feeding, and Judge Deering was assigned to the case. And he said that her low weight was evidence of starvation and not motivated by a bona fide right to privacy, but by a desire to terminate her life. And although the right to privacy was defined as the right to be left alone, he said that saving her life was paramount. So she continues to be force-fed. Of course, she appeals, and three justices of the Court of Appeals found in her favor, finally. And they said that she could refuse life-sustaining medical treatment, and in their decision they said, a desire to terminate one's life is probably the ultimate exercise of one's right to privacy. Moreover, they found no substantive evidence to support the lower court's decisions. The appeals court concluded that her mental and emotional feelings were quite entitled to respect. They said she has the right to refuse the increased dehumanizing aspects of her condition. The right to refuse medical treatment is basic and fundamental. The court then wrote that it sympathized with her plight. And they said, in Elizabeth Bouvier's view, the quality of her life has been diminished to the point of hopelessness, uselessness, unenjoyability, and frustration. Those are important words in terms of what we're looking at here. Hopeless, useless, unenjoyable, frustration. Quality of life is gone. She, as the patient, lying helplessly in bed, unable to care for herself, may consider her existence meaningless. She is not to be faulted for so concluding. As in all matters, lines must be drawn at some point somewhere, but that decision must ultimately belong to the one who is in the issue. And as to the precedent of forced feeding and what should be done in the future, the court said, we do not believe it is the policy of this state that every life must be preserved against the will of the sufferer. And then it goes on to say this is not a precedent. Is she finally given autonomy to make her own decisions then? And on what is this decision for autonomy based? Her right to privacy. That's doing the right. But how do we blend in the good here? What would love's commandment say? Is it enough to finally hear her and accede to her wishes? What is our responsibility in caring for the neighbor, if that's what our responsibility is?
Well, I keep thinking of the institutions of the church, like Bethany and Augustana Center, where profoundly disabled people live a life of many years, which is not meaningless and which is not hopeless, and that her medical condition does not need to be construed in those terms. There is another way.
Okay.
And what efforts are made pastorally or spiritually to engage her, I mean, not against her will, but in terms, there is another way to look at it. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Well, in concert with what you're saying, no one said in July 1985 in a magazine called The Sojourner, he was talking about another issue, but I think it works well here, so I copied it down. He said, I'm increasingly convinced that one of the greatest missionary tasks is to receive the fruits of the lives of the poor, the oppressed, and the suffering as gifts offered for the salvation of the rich. We who live in the illusion of control and self-sufficiency must learn true joy, peace, forgiveness, and love from our poor brothers and sisters. As long as we only want to give, we remain in the house of fear. So much giving can be a way of staying in control. Everyone's controlling Elizabeth's life except Elizabeth. And when Elizabeth is finally given permission to die, she doesn't. I'll tell you the end of the story now and we can go on. What Elizabeth does is, physician lawyer Scott received a free award from the state of California to reimburse him for the suits that he had had undergone on her behalf, and showed that the court would compensate attorneys who would otherwise be handling cases like this pro bono, because certainly she couldn't. And Elizabeth Bouvier at that time was still alive, and is at this point, from the last time I read this case in other literature, which was 1993, was still alive and maintaining herself. The decision was, from her perspective, the other literature that I've read says that she wanted the ability to make her own decisions, and she wasn't being given that right. What she wanted was what she got right here. When she became an adult and received some support, state support here from the community, what did she finally do? When the community came together and said, okay, you're an adult, here are the things you get. You get an apartment. And she said, fine, we give you some money. She said, fine, I'll get an apartment. I can hire a nurse. I can finally go to school. I'll get a degree. And with a degree, I can get a job. And then school said, no, we're not going to admit you into the master's program here, because, you know, this is limited and you have to apply and there are no jobs for people with your disabilities, so sorry. So she said, okay, I'll do some volunteer work and continue to live on the state support. And she met a friend through letter writing and ran into a bunch of roadblocks again. When she received help and was moving forward, she was fine. But when the help was replaced by a number of problems, she didn't know how to cope. She didn't have anything behind that. So what could have been done for her?
I argue the doctor helped her by not going along with her. She's alive today because he didn't agree.
Okay. That's one perspective.
He didn't assist her suicide.
But what's going on with her? From either a secular perspective or from a Christian perspective, what's happening?
She gained control back of her life. She had control there, and then when she started having all these crises and depressed, you know, got depressed, because us people who are healthy, we lose our jobs or whatever we go through. I mean, we're not as disabled, but how do we then deal with that lack of control and being out of control? And then once we get our job or we get control back and not have that powerlessness, then we can go on with life again.
Okay.
And I think she needed to find her own reason for living. Being told that she needed to live just for the sake of being alive or because we don't want you to die in our time or in our space wasn't enough. But to be able to find her own reason for living. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Nancy.
Well, I think that was what I meant when I was saying, what business was it of ours or of the communities to tell her what to do? When people lack a sense of having any control over their own situation, it's easy to see why they would lose the desire to go on. They have to have some control over some aspect of their life. And even if it's not in an exterior way, at least it needs to be sensed in an interior way. And if they don't have a sense of that, what is there?
Are there other issues you want to bring into this case or other cases regarding euthanasia? What about the whole idea of euthanasia today in 1995? What about our lives?
We faced it. My dad had been in and out of hospital many times, always revived with congenital aneurysm. And the last time he went in, my aunt called, and I called the hospital, and the doctor said, "Do you think we're going to lose him this time without, you know, major intervention," which meant machines and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I said, what did Dad feel? And he didn't think he was able to, he didn't think that was necessary. But he said that it'll go automatically. He said, if he becomes, you know, in danger, it's just going to be automatic unless we, the family, did something. And I said, well, I could have my brother call, because he was the oldest in the family. And I called him, and he agreed that Dad died peacefully, you know, quit this for a couple of months or maybe a little longer, who knows. It was all going to be on machines. And then I called the doctor back. He said, that's not going to work. He said, I have three brothers and three sisters, and they all have to agree. And they all have to let them know before they'll even consider. And then when they all did, he couldn't believe that a whole family would say, let Dad die peacefully. And then he rallied, and we thought he might rally again, and we made arrangements for care, home care now, because there was no way he's going to live alone anymore. And then when we had one day we didn't have covered when somebody was not there, and that's when he didn't want anybody to see him die either. That's when he died. Mm-hmm.
That happens often. Mm-hmm. That often happens. I've read a lot of literature, mostly in the last 8 years, 5 years, 5 to 8 years, about this because of similar situations in my own family. And that happens often, that people will, if they're in the hospital or if they're home, when they are alone, they will die. Many people do.
But I'm thinking age is what really is our problem. We feel if somebody has lived a long and good life, and we as Christians look forward to, you know, life hereafter anyway, that you have had your good life, you know, that's different than someone 25 years old who really hasn't had a chance, but it does look terribly, you know, I mean, you can understand too why she's not wanting to live any longer.
Yeah, I pulled this case on purpose because I think it's a very tough one, and because it brings in issues from places where we're not threatened, because we're not the neurosurgeon offering, we're not Richard Nixon, we're not Donald Fisher. It allows us to look at it from a position where we're not currently sitting, so we're not self-threatened.
One of the things that has happened since 84 and since Nancy Bouvier is that is the institution pretty much nationwide of a very serious attempt on the part of hospitals to provide everyone who comes in the door as an inpatient with an advance directive, which goes far beyond really what is a living will. And as part of that provides a power of attorney, a durable power of attorney, and tends to preclude then the questions which otherwise arise if someone becomes incompetent
or was it competent? Well, it had to be competent at the time it was originally signed. And really, you know, the interesting thing is that we're starting to, at least in the medical profession, go back to recognizing that death is a part of life. And contrary to what Peter says, I would maintain that the doctors see death as a part of life and part of the continuum, and that the role of doctors is not blindly to sustain life. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Catholic Church maintains, and I haven't seen anything on the part of Protestants, is that in bioethical decision making, a grid is used, and one of the ingredients of the grid is as a goal. What is the assuming the patient was autonomous and could define his or her own goal initially, that could be followed. Otherwise, the question has to be asked, really, is there any meaning in this person's life? And the Catholic Church would define a meaningful life as the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, I think you're talking...
That doesn't really apply to Nancy Bouvier, but as an overall standard, it's one which is pretty much universally applicable.
I think you may be talking about Al Johnson's casuistic grid out of the University of Washington.
He is one of the individuals, right?
Yeah. But that is an approach. It's different from the one I've introduced, but it is another. And, right. And it follows Joseph Fletcher's consequentialist response to this kind of, you know, what are the consequences? I'm not going in that direction. It would take us too long, and then we'd have to debate that approach versus another one. Bob?
Oh, I forgot. I was going to say, in some ways, this illustrates the larger problem that we're asking or struggling with in our society, and that is the quick move to talking about rights, the rights of the patient, the rights of the doctor, the rights of the hospital, and so forth, and the lack of a sense of a community working together to help this person discover, as some people said, where they would like to go, and so forth, and some creative options, and talking together, and not this breakdown and individualization right away. There was an article in the Twin Cities newspaper where they followed recently a young man who died of Lou Gehrig's disease, and the point of the article was to develop not only the spouse, but the friends and the family that gathered around him and took turns taking care of him, and his willingness and ability was his own spirituality to recognize that he's allowing them to take